The landscape was misty and vague. I was still on the hillside upon which this house now stands, and the shoulder rose above me gray and dim. I saw trees growing and changing like puffs of vapor, now brown, now green. They grew, spread, shivered, and passed away. I saw huge buildings rise up faint and fair and pass like dreams. The whole surface of the earth seemed changed, melting and flowing under my eyes. The little bands upon the dials that registered my speed raced round faster and faster. Presently, I noted that the sun belt swayed up and down from solstice to solstice in a minute or less, and that consequently my pace was over a year a minute. And minute by minute, the white snow flashed across the world and vanished, and was followed by the bright, brief green of spring. In one of the most memorable scenes from The Time Machine, H.G. Wells describes the sensation of time travel, and after he takes us hundreds of thousands of years into the future, he has a lot to say about the 20th and 21st centuries. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
In Wells' vision of the future, what did the brutal man-eating Morlocks represent, and who were the passive, victimized Eloi? How well does his science fiction classic stand the test of time? And what are the challenges to bringing the story to the stage? Our guest is Patricia Boyette, who recently adapted The Time Machine, and who will direct Saturday night's radio performance to be broadcast live here on WPR. From the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
The Time Machine, when we look at it now, it seems so amazing that it was written in 1895, because we're used to works about time traveling, but it was really the first, right?
It was very innovative. It was one of the first works to combine real science, hard facts, with fiction. And that became pretty much Wells's life work, and what really made him distinct was this combination of including science in his works of fantasy.
Some very specific things, too. I mean, in that passage that we started with, he talks about the belt, the sun belt, swaying up and down from solstice to solstice, which of course it does on the ecliptic over the course of a year. But he's taking these things that are relatively subtle, and then when you speed them up, he shows them to you in a kind of a rapid succession that you wouldn't necessarily think of.
Right. Well, he was a scientist. He studied science. He came from a low middle class background. His father was a cricketer, actually. And so he knew lower middle class life very well, and that comes out in a lot of his sociological aspects of his work. But in terms of science, he graduated with honors from London University and then taught science before he became a journalist and then fiction writer.
And he was born, what, just 7 years after Origin of the Species had come out.
Yeah.
And he had Huxley as a teacher. What difference did Darwin's evolutionary ideas
It affected
have?
Everything he did. Because this whole idea of evolution and then philosophically, sociologically, what that meant, he would speculate on. And that was the basis for all of his work.
You have this confluence of a lot of things going on in the 1860s, the time that Wells came onto the scene, 1870s. Not just Darwin, but of course all of the political theory of Marx and Hegel.
Right. And he embraced it and philosophized on all of it in terms of what it meant. And he, like all of them, thought that the evolution of mankind would be an evolution where man would get more intelligent and more civilized. And it's interesting in The Time Machine because quite the reverse is the case.
So, I mean, you'll have to wonder, is he just saying, well, it could be this way, or I believe it will be this way. You have to wonder a little bit.
It is, because he left some ambiguity there. On one hand, the time traveler is really dismayed with what's happened in the future. And on the other hand, there's so many versions here, but he also leaves open the possibility of going back into the future or going forward into the future and trying to do something to help civilization continue in a more positive direction.
But is it fair to say that for the most part, Wells comes across as a pessimist? Because if you think of the War of the Worlds or the Time Machine, it's not really a cheerful, upbeat vision.
No, it's not. No, he is. And he was rather an irascible person, as I understand, too. Had very deep convictions, but that also made him very impatient with other people. Their points of view on things.
Why don't you believe what I believe?
One of the things that I tripped across, just in understanding Wells a little bit, that was very surprising, is toward the end of his wife's life, and she died quite a bit earlier than he did, she wrote a book and of stories and poems, and he wrote the introduction to it, which was very tender and very a very different tone than all of his own work, which I thought was very interesting. A little insight into the man.
Was this the first wife or the second wife that he ran off with?
Oh, first wife.
First wife.
Well, there was another thing, too, a major factor that had been going on for some time in the 19th century, and that was, of course, the Industrial Revolution, which was, of course, also feeding into this whole political philosophy as to working class versus leisure class, which would probably have been much more obvious in England than, say, it would be in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this really sets a foundation for what happens with the Eloi and the Morlocks as well. The speculation is the Eloi evolved from the leisure class and the Morlocks were the working class who had to work in the factories and with all this machinery until they evolved, as Darwin
predicted, each in its own way.
You know, it reminds you of the French Revolution in some ways in terms of the class division. But this actually goes into the physical aspects of the human being as well as
What do we have from Wells' writings leading up to the Time Machine, and not necessarily in the realm of science fiction, but including that in terms of these issues? Do we see it at all before the Time Machine, do you know?
Not so much that I know of. I mean, I'm not really an authority on this, so I can't speak absolutely to this. But I think that this was really quite seminal.
Well, after all, he's only, 26
when he comes out? He was 29 when he wrote this. This was only his second book.
And where do you think he got the idea of time traveling and the notion of sort of, I mean, where did that come from?
Well, I think this idea of the fourth dimension that was bantered about by scientists, but it was pure theory. And it's interesting because what he has in terms of the basic science of the idea of the fourth dimension, duration of time, it really preceded what Albert Einstein came up with years and years and years later.
What does he have to say about that fourth dimension in the Time Machine?
That the three dimensions are length, width, breadth. And he argues that time is another aspect of space. And if the first three dimensions can be manipulated,
you can move on a vertical, horizontal line.
Right. Then you should be able to move along the time continuum as well. And and he goes more in terms of that this might be something that needs to be thought of, rather than experienced in the way that the other three dimensions are experienced. But dreams, memories have a way of transporting us forward and back. And are they not real? And so there was speculation, imagination.
But all you have to do is build a machine to pull it off.
Exactly, exactly.
In your adaptation, you have the professor say about time being a fourth dimension, that, I mean, one of the examples he gives is, here's a portrait of a man at 8 years old, another at 15, another at 17, another at 23, and so on. All of these are three-dimensional representations of his four-dimensional being, which is a fixed and unalterable thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we can be the same three-dimensional person, but mm-hmm. depending on where we are in time, mm-hmm. it adds a different dimension.
Absolutely.
That we're never Absolutely. Really the same because we're constantly changing.
Absolutely. And he uses the example of, you know, the technology of the day, the steam engine and going up in a balloon, how that has allowed humankind to adjust these dimensions. And so why not further technology, further inventions, being able to manipulate things further?
When Wells wrote this, I mean, it's all well and good to write a novella. This is about, 38,000 words or something like that, a slender book. It's all well and good to write it, but then you have to come to terms with your editor, too. And what was Wells' relationship with his editor?
Well, it was very interesting and unusual because in 1895, there were two editions that came out simultaneously. The American edition, which was the Holt edition, that it speculated that this was actually the first one that he wrote. It's much more straightforward. It's less flowery. It's a bit shorter. And actually, we're basing a lot of our work on that because it works with the old-time radio broadcast better than the other. And then there was the Heinemann edition that was the British edition that's seen as being standard.
Did he dumb it down for Americans?
You know, I don't know. I think rather than dumbing it down, I think he built it up for the British. He elaborated more for the British.
And what sort of things did he elaborate on? The philosophical, political parts of it?
There are some changes in it, but it's mainly, I think, the language. The language is much more flowery. It's much more Victorian, where the language in the Holt edition is much more straightforward.
Well, we know that radio versions of the War of the World have a huge history mm-hmm. in terms of stimulating all kinds of public panic and so mm-hmm. on. What about the history behind various versions that have been done in the past of the time machine, both in terms of radio adaptations and films?
Yeah, well, the film versions, of course, there's two main film versions, the classic 1960 film that stars Rod Taylor and Yvette Mimieux. And all the adaptations take certain liberties and go different places and add different characters. I mean, I don't know how it could not. This just sparks your imagination in any particular time or place. So there's that version. And then there was the Guy Pearce version in, I think it was 1984, and that has Jeremy Irons playing kind of this shaman leader of the Morlocks that was completely fabricated for that particular film. Both have been very popular. I think the 1960s in particular has survived as a classic. The radio versions, it's been interesting. There was a 1947 or 48 version, half-hour version, Escape, on the Escape radio program. And
then it was redone, I think probably the same script, different cast, in 1950 with John Daner as the time traveler, because he was your all-purpose radio actor. But, boiled down into half an hour.
Right, which is tough to do with this. It's very tough to do. And then there was a 1997 version called Alien Voices that was done by Leonard Nimoy, Spock of
Star Trek fame.
Star Trek, right. And that's a two-hour version that they did, and they made up characters again. The Eloi had no trouble speaking, so
Even though there were a few hundred thousand years of
in
English
advance,
language
they
development.
Still spoke English quite well. And he had some male Eloi's speaking, as well as Weena, who's the Eloi that we know from the original. And then BBC, just a few years ago, put out a version that was set in World War II.
And set in World War II?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Kind of
the interviewer, there's a woman interviewer, an American journalist, who goes and visits H.G. Wells, who died in 1946. Mm-hmm. So it was just before his death. And Wells essentially tells her this story of the time traveler. You're not sure whether he's the time traveler or...
Yeah, because the time traveler is never named, is he?
No.
Then how did he get the name Dudley? Was that just a fabrication of one of the early radio adaptations?
Yeah. So these names, some of them I just made up, and others were taken either from the original or one of the adaptations.
Do we know how Wells would have felt about such liberties?
Interesting question. No, I don't have a clue.
Well, we already know that he was sort of tinkering a little bit against his will with it for that early editor, so he probably would not have been totally thrilled by some of the adaptations.
Right, and a part of it, there's a lot of reasons for the adaptations. I mean, there have been a lot through time, but it's now in public domain as well, so that's another incentive.
I suppose one reason that that radio adaptations work well for science fiction is that you can imagine the things, because the minute you put something in a film, whether it's a monster or an alien creature or some technological advancement, there, you know, you're limited because you see it and it, it can look phony or...
Yeah, that zipper in the back of the Morlock.
You know, it just doesn't do it. It just doesn't
But
do
with
it.
Radio, you get the words and then you can kind
it's
of the create
imagination.
The pictures for science fiction.
It's been interesting because I've been looking into radio drama more and more recently, and there seems to be a resurgence of interest and more radio drama happening all over. Here in town, we had two in the last... year. Forward Theater Company did 39 Steps, a radio version. And we did old-time radio, bringing back some of the old comedy routines.
Back in April.
And it seems that we're not alone. There's a lot of cities and countries beginning to do this. And I think there is something having to do with the imaginative elements.
Well, it's that theater of the mind. You know, Stephen Vincent Benet called it theater of the mind, and that kind of summarizes it. Of course, from a more, what shall we say, mundane standpoint, it's also a manageable budget.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's much easier to produce.
What led you to think that there was a need for a new adaptation, if there's all these other versions?
Well, you know, every time you do any kind of performance, radio or not, there are different conditions. So we knew we had 1 hour, and we're doing it in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery Space, which is not a regular studio. It's not a regular stage. And we knew that we wanted to use the talent from Department of Theater and Drama, University Theater. So we were trying to tailor it for all of those needs, and the audience, and the science festival going
and
on.
It just as a little sidebar to that, to the space in which this is to be performed, you say, is not your conventional stage, to say the least. It's actually pretty close to being in a flying saucer, because it's a perfectly circular room with a slight dome in the middle with the light color and intensity changeable. Mm-hmm. And also a pretty crazy echo underneath that dome. But the rest of it is the way it's lit and the shape of it and the sound of it. It's really rather like being in a flying saucer. It certainly invites some kind of science fiction.
It really lends itself to this kind of thing. Absolutely.
I think Wells called his work a scientific romance because there wasn't even the term science fiction yet.
Right.
It's a scientific romance, kind of mixture of fantasy and science.
Right.
Yeah, the romance not being so much in the sense between the time traveler and Weena, as she's, 4 feet tall?
All the Eloi are about 4 feet tall.
Nothing wrong with being short. Just <saying.
No. laughs> Don't I know?
But, it's romance in the sense of...
of fantasy.
Imagination,
Imagination. Fantasy.
We're going to look at the adaptation of The Time Machine when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
The time traveler, for so it will be convenient to speak of him, was expounding a recondite matter to us. His gray eyes shone and twinkled, and his usually pale face was flushed and animated. The fire burned brightly, and the soft radiance of the incandescent lights and the lilies of silver caught the bubbles that flashed and passed in our glasses. Our chairs, being his patents, embraced and caressed us rather than submitted to be sat upon, and there was that luxurious after-dinner atmosphere when thought runs gracefully free of the trammels of precision. And he put it to us in this way, marking the points with a lean forefinger as we sat and lazily admired his earnestness over the new paradox, as we thought it, and his fecundity. Well, you wouldn't write it that way exactly today, but that's the opening to the 1895 novella, The Time Machine by H.G. Wells, which certainly launches one's curiosity and speculative powers. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Patricia Boyette, who has done a stage adaptation of The Time Machine. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I say, Patricia, that wouldn't work too well for the stage. It's a little bit, what would you say, retrograde in the progression of the ideas.
A little
hard to follow in some ways. So how do you, to put it in film terms, cut to the chase with The Time Machine?
Mm. Well, we're doing this performance for radio, so it has to be something that the actors can readily get involved with and the audience receives. So we simplified a lot of the language. So maybe I'll read just the equivalent part, what you just read in our adaptation.
And you have it spoken by a young student?
Yes. In the original novella, there's the time traveler. He's never really identified by name. And he goes alone into the future on the time machine. And that's very difficult for radio because it becomes a monologue. And so Wells, as we spoke of earlier, was a scientist who became a journalist and then a writer. So we introduced a character, and this has been done in earlier adaptations as well. We're not the first person to do this, or the first adaptation to do this. We introduced a second character, so they both go into the future. And the second character is a younger journalist, and the time traveler is a scientist professor. It gives us dialogue, which is much easier to listen to and gives us some variety in telling the story. So we have Philby, who is the younger journalist, speaking to the audience about the time traveler. And he's gone into the future with the time traveler, whom we've called Professor Dudley. And that name is taken from several adaptations of the time machine. So, this is Philby at the very beginning of our adaptation. The man who made the time machine, the man whom I shall call Professor Dudley, has been well known in scientific circles for a number of years, and therefore the fact of his mysterious disappearance is also well known. He was a mathematician of particular subtlety, and one of our most conspicuous investigators in molecular physics. He did not confine himself to abstract science alone, but also had several ingenious and one or two very profitable patents that afforded him a handsome house and laboratory in Richmond. Up to the last, there was held at his home a kind of informal gathering, which it was my privilege to attend, and where, at one time or another, I met some of the most distinguished literary and scientific figures of the day. Every Thursday, there was a plain dinner served at 7, followed by an adjournment to his sumptuous library, where, over a brightly burning fire and with libations of alcohol and tobacco, we would invoke the muses of conversation and invention. At first, the conversation was mere fragmentary chatter, but toward 9 or 9:30, if the muses favored us, some particular topic would surface through a kind of natural selection. So it was, I remember, on that last Thursday evening that I first learned of the time machine.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. Wonderfully compact and also concrete. And you got that natural selection in there, too. That was kind of cute.
Well, we're trying to get as much in as we can. It's a big novel. There's a lot to write about there.
I noticed in the opening conversation that follows this at the gathering that the older guests are much more skeptical. They're
absolutely
not going to go along with the idea of the time traveler, but it is the younger student who kind of keeps an open mind.
Yes, yes, yes. So we have the conservative professor and scientist. And in some of the versions, we have the professor, the time traveler, is even more irascible in saying, well, first you've got to clear your mind of what you learned in school because it's all garbage and, you know, it was based on false assumptions. And he's also seen as being a kind of a mad scientist type. Mm. As being almost dangerous to himself because he's such a genius.
That's such a long tradition, isn't it? When I think back, I mean, you know, Captain Nemo and Jules Verne. Jules Verne has sometimes been compared to H.G. Wells, as has Edgar Allan Poe. But Captain Nemo and then, of course, Victor Frankenstein creating his monster, they all were, so many of them at least, on the periphery when it came to the understanding and sympathy of their peers.
Yes, absolutely. There's a little bit of the same section, the same beginning, and this is just a little bit taken from the Escape radio drama from 1948. When I met Professor Dudley, I thought of him as having one of those intellectual minds that was tragically too brilliant. Whether it was due to the pressure of trying to outdo himself, or out of complete frustration of being constantly misunderstood, or just out of utter boredom, no matter what the cause, I was quite certain he was mad. And I wasn't alone. That's how his guests talked about him behind his back. They would politely smile and understandingly nod their heads during his monthly dinner parties, secretly grateful more for the food than for the company or conversation. So, again, it's a spin.
Also
on
quite
all
credible.
Of this.
Mm.
It's interesting that when he's talking in your adaptation, when he's talking to Philby about time travel, he does mention the idea of traveling that we all do every night in dreams.
Yes.
Because that helps, I think, set up the whole journey, the whole narrative, as something that we can respond to as part of the human experience, even if we don't buy the scientific you know, time travel through sort of in the scientific sense, we can certainly respond on a human level to the fact that we can travel all over the place in dreams.
Right. And he opens reality to the metaphysical, not just to the physical world. And in our version, one place where he's trying to explain to the other professors, he says, "But my dear madam, we do move about in time. That is just where the whole world has gone wrong. We are always going away from the present moment. For instance, if I am recalling an incident vividly, I go back to the instance of its occurrence. I become absent-minded, as you say. I jump back in time for a moment. Of course, we have no means of staying back there for any length of time, any more than a leaping animal has of staying suspended 6 feet above the ground. But, unlike the animal, a human being is better off in this respect. He can question and expand his knowledge and experience of the world and its physical science as we know it. He can go up against gravitation due to the invention of the balloon. Why should he not hope that ultimately he may be able to invent something that will allow him to stop or accelerate his drift along the time dimension, or even turn about and travel the other way?"
And when the others, the skeptics, have left this dinner gathering, leaving behind the more accepting Philby, we have our first look at the time machine. It looks like one of those horseless carriages, but Philby asks, where are the wheels? And what is that huge crystal disc in the back? Is that a new kind of engine? To which Dudley says, of course, it's a time machine.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a wonderful Victorian quality to it. It's made of quartz and bronze and ivory.
Yes,
these are not materials
yes,
you
no,
would use
it's
in
very,
constructing a time machine
right,
today, are they?
Very, very Victorian. And I think the 1960 movie, The Time Machine, in that, I think was very authentic in terms of the description in the novella. You know, and it looks like a cross between a horseless carriage and Santa's sleigh or something. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And this idea of energy coming from crystals and there being
still,
a power
that's
still
with us today.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, you won't have the visual part, but what are you doing with sound in this adaptation?
Well, we're going to do Foley sound. So we have a student, a sound student from theater and drama, who's going to be doing live sound effects. We're just starting today to integrate these into rehearsal, so I'm very exciting. And we have a pianist who's going to be composing some of and playing on keyboard some of the music that goes behind.
So what does this time machine sound like?
I don't know yet. I don't
Tune
know
in
yet.
To find out.
Yeah, well, this is part of what's really interesting about this project, too, because it's very improvisational, and it's been a real work of ensemble among people. So we're layering in things as we go, and we have the whole crew together now to be able to start adding the elements of sound and lights and going into the space this week to see how we can work that space. So it's been very exciting that way.
Is there anything, as you've been working on this production of The Time Machine, where you run into it and it seems incredibly relevant to today?
Yeah, I think, you know, it touches on class separation, upper class, lower class, no middle class. The imagination of, well, time, the fascination with time and just what that is still with us. And speculation about the future. So there's several things that are still very much with us. Some of the social concerns. Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? If they're getting worse, what should we do about that?
Well, I suppose by setting it, you have it set in the year 100,080. Mm-hmm. We won't have to worry about getting to that point and finding mm-hmm. out if this adaptation made sense the way mm-hmm. Orwell with 1984, mm-hmm. it gets there and then you can kind of mm-hmm. measure things. So it's set so far in the future mm-hmm. that it becomes quite bizarre. Mm-hmm. Then.
But it's where are we on that spectrum? You know, that's interesting to contemplate. In the original novel, the year that the time travel travels to is actually 800 and something. And in a lot of the adaptations, including ours, we only took them to 100,080 because there's some references to the geographical location. And the time machine travels through time, but not location. So it's exactly the same location.
Well, and that's key to the story.
Yes, absolutely. And so referencing ruined buildings that are still there, I mean, even after 100,000 years, that might tax the imagination a little bit. But 800,000 seemed a little bit far-fetched for some of the elements that we included in our version.
And when you get there to that wonderful year of 100,080, Philby tells us in very succinct words about the two components of life at that time. He says, it seemed absolutely incredible. A dream, and a pleasant one, for the garden in which we found ourselves was beautiful and summery, the air perfumed with strange flowers and greenery. At some distance we could see a large imposing building of white marble in the shape of something like a winged sphinx, with wings spread so that it seemed to hover. There was something ominous about the unseeing eyes and the faint shadow of a smile on the lips of this strange architectural beast. The pedestal appeared to be made of bronze and was thick with verdigris. It was greatly weather-worn and imparted an unpleasant suggestion of disease. But everything was completely quiet and peaceful around it. Perhaps too quiet. An unfathomable strangeness sent a shiver up my spine. Mm. So right away in this beautiful pastoral setting, it's something is rotten.
There's something, yeah. There's something that's absolutely unnatural about the whole thing.
There's also a funny mixture of, you know, we've gone far into the future, but you've got this reference to this ancient sphinx. What about that white marble sphinx-like building?
Well, my feeling of it is that, and again, this is just me, but in my imagination, it was like a neoclassical movement in society at some point previous to that. But neoclassical in a way that a society that, you know, had some negativity, some...
But in...
That was maybe, you know, more fascistic or something like that.
In more immediate terms.
Powerful, you know.
As far as the storyline, though, it's a predator. The Sphinx was a predator in, you know, the works of Sophocles, for example. And also that slight smile in the air of mystery. And that feeling of, well, you know, whenever we call, you will come and...
Yes.
We will eat you.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, it's interesting because rather than, I think it was our dramaturg who alluded to this, that rather than H.G. Wells being a successor to Aldous Huxley, at the time he was seen as being a successor to Edgar Allan Poe in terms of the imagery and the gruesomeness of...
Yeah, that is a rather Poe-like image, isn't it?
Yeah, something that looks at first beautiful and then it's got worms.
Exactly,
or something
exactly, exactly.
I suppose by referring back to something that's ancient Egyptian too, you think of all the slave labor that went into the construction of the wonders of the world kind of thing,
well,
too.
Well, and that, the severity of that civilization, you know, the marvels that they were able to create, but the severity behind it all.
Exactly.
We're going to talk about the little people, the Eloi, and also the ones underneath, the Morlocks, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
We were caught in the year 100,080. The time machine was gone. The bronze door of the monument held. Our retreat was cut off. The thin line by which we could make our way back home, back to our own time, our own people, back to 1902, was broken. And the little people's language was still a mystery. Any time we tried to communicate with them, our efforts were met with howls of laughter. But it wasn't hostile. They weren't taunting us. Their attitude was innocent. They were like simple wondering children. Only one, the young woman whose life we had saved on that first day, became truly interested in us and was able to tell us her name. It was Weena. She always kept close to us. She went with us wherever we walked and slept near us at night in the hall. She'd always make us garlands and bring us flowers, which she would sometimes drop in our pockets. The very idea of pockets being somewhat of a mystery and delight to her. I was pleasantly surprised that Professor Dudley was not furious with her for this. I suppose the main thing was that we had a friend in her. As time went on, we were able to teach her a few words of English and learn a few words of her language. Now that we could communicate some ideas, we'd redoubled our efforts like men racing against the clock so that we might speak to her and discover the secret of our immense loss.
That's a passage from the radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Patricia Boyette, who has done an adaptation of the famous 1895 Time Machine by H.G. Wells. It's going to be performed Saturday night at 8:30 and broadcast live on Wisconsin Public Radio. It'll be part of the Wisconsin Science Festival. Well, that idea that we've traveled into the future and then are trapped and can't get back to our own time, that theme comes up in a lot of later science fiction works as well, where this dangerous notion that we're going to go on an adventure but then get stuck.
Right. And actually, that's always the way of adventure, isn't it? I mean, you know, that there's
no guarantee
at all of being able to come back. Yes, yeah, so in this future, the land of the Elois and Morlocks, the Elois are these little people about 4 feet tall who are lovely, but they're like preschool children. The time traveler is quite disgusted with the idea that humanity has not evolved in knowledge and science, but has
devolved
into, being children, quite helpless and not ambitious at all. And then the Morlocks are discovered. I'll read just a little bit introducing the Morlocks. This is a bit of a dialogue between the time traveler, Professor Dudley, and Philby, his young journalist sidekick, who goes into the future with him. Philby speaks. In the clearing, we found a round, well-like opening. Professor Dudley and I leaned over and looked down a deep shaft. A small white creature was retreating down a ladder in the well, like a human spider, its large white eyes watching us as it went swiftly down and then disappeared in the shaft. Dudley says, "Philby, did you see it? Like an ape?" "Yes, but also like a man." "So there are two species of humans in this world." "Yes." "The little people above ground and this obscene thing, this bleached monster below." "That white appearance is common to animals that live in the dark, like huge rats, like worms that are cold to the touch. I know because they've touched me."
So what do we make of the albino nature of these creatures underground?
Yeah, well, I think that the idea is that the Morlocks devolved from working class, from the poor who were made to slave away at machinery, industrialization.
In dark places.
Darkness in the dark places because the machinery was ugly, so it was kept away. And the Eloi were the upper classes who lived above, but the power was really with the Morlocks, so they are now the rulers of this world. And the Eloi are merely cattle, chattel, to be culled at will.
So there's really no winners in this world, because the ones underground, they may have the control, but they're living underground in a sort of miserable, hell-like existence. Mm-hmm. And the ones above may look as if they're in some idyllic, heavenly place, but they're being eaten.
Mm-hmm.
So not really a lot of hope there.
Right. Well, in our adaptation, which is borrowed from some other adaptations, and I think along the line there's you want some kind of hope at the end of this journey. So we have the time traveler, and this is also in the 60s film and several other adaptations, where the time traveler, after coming back to his own time, and in our version, you know, with Philby, Philby comes back to 1902, and he absolutely blacks out from the experience. And when he wakes up, the time traveler is gone. And there's a speculation that he's gone back to Weena and
to make a difference.
Exactly, the Eloi and the Morlock, to see if he can rectify things and make a difference in civilization.
There's a wonderful bit in that 1960 movie. I don't know if it's in any of the other adaptations or where it came from, but at the end where the time traveler has, you know, disappeared back into the future, and a friend of his is talking to the housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the study. This is where the time machine is kept. And he notices everything is intact, except she says, "Oh, but there are three books missing." And he says, "Which three would you have taken?"
Exactly.
And, into the future to change.
And
to
we've actually used that. It was too good an idea.
And do you use the part where there are flowers in the pocket?
Yes.
From Weena?
Yes.
There has to be something that proves it
really
happened. Absolutely.
Right? We also have we had to change things a little bit because they were going to take Weena back in time with them.
That would make for a different story, wouldn't it?
Yes, it does. But again, we had to collapse a lot of things, so we had to rearrange things a little bit. And there's a piece of her tunic in his hand, and also he finds the flower in the pocket.
This flower that doesn't exist yet in 1902.
Right, exactly.
And how
exactly.
do you see, I guess, H.G. Wells working out some of his ideas on class? I mean, here is a man who was the son of a maid, the son of, as you said, a cricket player. And you know, so he's from the working classes, really, living in a time where there's colonialism and looking at this class division. What are we to make of his presentation of upper, literally upper and lower classes, but this division of people.
Well, I think that this is one of the themes throughout his work, as he looks at this, and I think he showed the lower middle class in a lot of his work, with a lot of humor and a lot of warmth. But as we mentioned a little while ago, there was a lot of interest in socialism and in social classes that was going on at the time. And a lot of his works, not all of his works were novels or works of fiction. He had a lot of sociological works.
And history, too.
Yes, history, having to do with the way what they called lunatics at the time were treated and what lunacy was all about, the women's vote. So there were several social issues that he wrote about directly. So I think it's something that he thought about a great deal and wrestled with. It's interesting in Time Machine, there's not neither the Eloi or the Morlocks are totally good and bad, and more so in some versions than in the original by far.
Are the Eloi in any way taking a poke at the sort of the dandies, the feet, Oscar Wilde types?
I think so, very much so, very much so.
Continue on this path, and a few hundred thousand years from now, this could be you. from a dramatic standpoint, though, you have this conflict between the Eloi and the Morlocks, neither of whom are great conversationalists. So how do you turn that into a radio play?
All right. Well, that's one of the reasons we needed at least dialogue between two people. And in the novella, Weena doesn't need to speak, but in a radio drama, it helps if she can.
And she talks in the movies.
Right. And in some of the versions, they just ignore the fact that, you know, people 100,000 years from now might speak English or not. And so we just had this one creature, Weena, who they rescue from a Morlock. They don't know that at the time, but they hear these cries, and they rescue her from a Morlock, and she befriends them, and she has more curiosity than the rest of them and is a quick learner.
That helps if you have a time limit on your radio program.
It does. So she learns a few words of English, and they learn a few words of Eloi, and they're able to communicate enough to do what we need to do there with the drama. But it's tough. It's tough. And this is one of the challenges, too, because the novella is actually so visual in its writing, and we need to honor that as best we can, but there are no visuals for the radio audience. So
well,
how
now
do we
it
do
must
that?
Be particularly good, though, when he goes down into Morlock land where it's dark. Now, that would be great radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's lovely. I mean, trying to be able to conjure up all the visuals as much as we can through the language, because that's what radio is. So.
And why put it as part of a Wisconsin Science Festival?
Well, it was it's the first work, or it's credited by many as being the first work to include hard science with fiction. And we thought it would be fun The title of the evening is An Evening of Invention and Imagination. So we've got the invention of the television, and we've got the invention of the time machine. So we've got a nice
yeah, it will be coupled before broadcast
bookending
with
there.
A reading of the Farnsworth experiment, which is about television.
So we've got a good bookending there. So mainly that. And we were requested to do something having to do with science fiction. It's just adding another color to the festival.
Okay, now I have to ask. I don't know how much you know at this point, Patricia, but what are you going to do with those Morlocks anyway? I mean, we have to have at least some audio from them.
We're working on that.
Something going on there.
We've definitely got audio. In terms of what we've got visual, we'll have to see, because that's one of our layers that we're just adding now.
Do you think the Morlocks are going to growl, or...?
Yeah, we've got a whole vocabulary going on, depending on what's happening, because they have to. One of the problems is we had generic growls for a while, and that won't work. So we've got to have a Morlock rehearsal to see what's going on with the Morlocks.
I suppose you need to make them both scary but also human in some way.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And, as in any kind of acting, the actor has to know what is going on at that particular moment and respond in the moment. And
if the production and the broadcast go the way you want them to go, what would the audience go away with? If they leave the theater or turn off the radio at the end of this, what do you hope that they will feel that they didn't before?
Well, I hope it will be enjoyable, entertaining, and thought-provoking. And I think that's what H.G. Wells intended with his novella.
Entertainment and thought-provoking, and maybe a little in the Grecian sense of arousing pity and fear.
Absolutely. Something to think about.
Well, it sounds very intriguing. We'll look forward to hearing it on the radio live, The Time Machine, as written by H.G. Wells and adapted by Patricia Boyette, who will be the director of this university theater production that is being broadcast in conjunction with the Wisconsin Science Festival Saturday night coming, 8:30, as part of the old-time radio drama block here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.